Okay. So, the title of the talk, genetic selection versus visual appraisal, is it a conundrum? I think the goal of our talk is to really convince you that no, it's not. And I hope it, at the end of our presentation, you see that there's opportunities for us to make selection, and there's different tools for us to use in making selection, and we should use the right tools at the right time. I think that's maybe as good a summary as we can give you. I want to point you to some resources, though. One of the things that is really important to recognize in obviously in genetics is it's changing fast. Who's in the audience is super comfortable with the state of your knowledge relative to beef genetics and genomics today? Right? I'm going to put my hand down. It changes really quickly. The amount of change in our business over the last 12 to 18 months has been pretty phenomenal. The thing I want to remind us, though, is that the basics haven't changed. Okay, we can track or approach selection in much the same way as we have for many years, in a very systematic approach. And one of the books, I think, or publications that does a good job outlining that approach is this Beef Sire Selection Manual that was put together through the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium. A whole litany of different topics covered. I'll just point you to the website, nbcec.org, or if you just Google Beef Sire Selection Manual, this is always the first result. Good reading and cure for insomnia, okay? Yeah, a few people caught that. Good. We're paying attention. Excellent. So this first step, whenever we want to talk about selection, is, and this is the painful part, the really fun part, right, is actually going out and doing the selection, right? That's the part we all love doing. We like to go to the bullpen or the heifer pen, sort through the candidates. That's the fun part. The unfun part, but the $500 an hour work, is really spending time to understand what it is we're selecting for. Okay, what is our objective? Okay, and so one of the things I'll encourage you to do, and many of you that have heard me speak before, this isn't a new exercise, but it's important to sort of redo it periodically, and it is develop a breeding objective. So just a written statement about your operation that defines not only sort of the environmental constraints that exist, but most certainly, when do you sell your animals? And in what method do you sell them, okay? How do you provide labor at certain periods of time? A number of years ago when I was at Mizzou, I just Googled breeding objective, and this is one of the first ones that came up from a commercial operation in New Zealand. And many of you have already read this. Our objective is to breed cattle that breed as yearlings, calve unassisted, and rear good calf for sale at weaning every year. We aim to build functional cattle that flesh easily and can forage over the hills over winter, but must have temperament and soundness to be farmed intensively during calving and breeding season. Okay? We've got a pretty clear picture about this operation in our head, right? We know what things are important, okay? We have, from our own experience, an understanding of the importance of calving ease and weaning weight performance as it drives profitability in that operation. What's one thing that's not on there that should be on? So I want you guys to go home and you know, do this on the back of the napkin at the bar tonight or over a cup of coffee with your spouse when you get home. This is a good exercise because it keeps us focused on the things that are important in selection. Okay, what's one activity that should be on your list or is on your list? Many of you have probably already done it this fall. That's not on this description. Cull cows. Well, cull cows require something else, and that's what should be on your list. Replacements. How do you replace females in your breeding herd? Do you raise your own replacements? Do you buy bred heifers? Do you buy bred three-year-old? How do you replace cows? Okay, so put that in your description. Okay, the point of this exercise is to really focus us on the traits that are important to your operation. Not the traits that are important to some guy down the road or some producer, you know, halfway across the country. What's important to your operation, okay? And hopefully what this gets us pointed to is what's important for profitability in your operation, okay? And we'll talk about that in just a minute, okay? One of the things that is really important to recognize, and I think becoming more and more important, is understanding that maximum trait selection often probably not our objective if we're a commercial producer, right? Finding the optimal level, maximum might be the optimal level in your operation for some particular trait. But maximums in biology, the extremes in biology always come with consequence, right? So thinking through what is an acceptable level of mature weight in lactation? What is an acceptable level of calving ease? How much is too much calving ease? Okay. Thinking through the optimization in areas of feed availability, stress. This is a slide from adapted from some work that Jim Gozy did that describes different levels of the production environment in terms of these different core kind of traits or features. Okay, feed availability and stress define the production environment, and then there's a whole set of traits. Okay. So many of you, I can see you're going through figuring out, okay, my operation, we're in short grass country, variable rainfall, limited forage availability, whatever it is, figuring out what are the appropriate levels is a fair bit of the battle, okay? Maximum calving ease, maximum yearling weight, maximum milk, maximum carcass is likely not the optimal solution for anyone in this room, okay? Figuring out the optimum one is what drives profitability, okay? The most important things I learned from Bob Taylor, Colorado State University, beef production class. He asked this about every day in class. How do we define profitability in cow-calf production? Okay, it's profits, revenue minus cost. Okay, we can make it a lot more complicated than this. Okay, but at the end of the day, revenue things in our production system are generally fairly easy to measure. Right, those are the outputs. Okay. How much did we sell calves for? What was the gross paycheck we got from our calf weaning weight? Or what was the value of those steers we hung up on the rail? Okay, that's pretty easy to quantify. Okay, quantifying the cost structure of our operation without some pretty good accounting is difficult. Okay, it is difficult with good accounting, but it's really important to understand the profit position. Okay, and what we need to do is be able to connect our ideas relative to these revenue and cost streams back to our selection objectives, right? Practicing selection without understanding that, I think, is what our friend Dorian Garrett called a hobby, right, Dr. Spangler? Okay? If you have enough money that you can select for anything and the outcome doesn't matter, profitability in cow-calf production is probably not the primary focus of your operation, right? If profitability is really important in your operation, and I suspect for many of you it is, getting your arms around this and then making the connection to which traits are important is really critical, okay? So back to selection. Well, how do we describe then differences in the traits that are of economic importance to beef producers? And principally where this happens, right, is the interface between seed stock producers and commercial cow-calf producers, right? How do we describe value when we buy genetics? How do we describe value? What is the currency that we use to communicate value? Okay. Matt and I are a little biased, I suspect, based on our training and background, but we think it's EPDs and selection indexes, right? That's how we describe genetic potential for seed stock animals that are going into commercial operations. And ultimately, phenotype of those animals, other than a few traits, and we'll talk about those towards the end, the genetic predictors are what matter. Okay, there's a few traits where things we use phenotypic data for, but if you're going to communicate value and try and solve this optimization problem, EPDs and selection index provide that. Okay, so this brings us to the idea of the connection between the profit equation and our breeding objective really stems or works through the idea of what are the economically relevant traits, okay? And many of you have heard this term before, but an ERT is simply a trait that either has a cost directly associated with it or a revenue stream directly associated with it, okay? So cost or revenue. The other traits that may have a genetic association or some relationship to our system is called an indicator trait. So the two categories are either ERTs or indicators, okay? So as an example, is birth weight or calving ease the ERT? Many of you have seen this example before. Calving ease or ERT? Calving ease or birth weight, the ERT, okay? Which one costs us money? Dead calf, right? Dead calf is a function of not only birth weight, but a whole bunch of other things associated with Cavigny's performance or lack of dystocia, right? Okay. So is birth weight unimportant in our system? No, it's important to us for two reasons. One, we don't directly sell calves on birth weight, obviously, but it accounts for a part of the genetic variation that we see in Cavigny's. But it's also positive. That's a negative association, right? If birth weight goes up, dystocia also goes up. Or positively related with dystocia, negatively associated with Cavigny's per se. Okay, but birth weight's also positively associated with what else? That's important for many of us. Well, what about weaning weight? Okay. If we select for lower birth weights on average, we get lower weaning weights on average. Okay. Is that a goal of anybody in the room? Probably not. Okay. So we got to be careful and put selection pressure on the traits that are really important and are the ERTs. Okay. I want to remind us that the importance of traits differs based on objective. Okay. If we think about a production system that's a traditional beef firm that sells calves at, say, weaning time, okay, in that scenario, this is work done by Brian Melton in the mid-90s with a sort of an early selection index profit equation approach. He found that traits describing reproduction were 10 times as important as in product and 5 times for growth related to end product. So this is a 2-to-1 relationship, 5-to-1 relative to end product, okay? But what happens if we own the product clear to the rail, okay, clear to harvest? Do these numbers stay the same or do they change? They change, right? And in an integrated beef firm where we retain ownership and sell them on the rail, reproduction now is just twice as important as in product or growth, okay? So understanding the objective, remember that was the first step we did, making sure we're connected the traits that are important, their relative importance to our production objective is really key. Okay. So Matt, how do we inform our selection decisions? What data do we use?
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I know you, like I, have a leadership or oversight of our respective seed stock herds at KSU and UNL. And those of you that know me know that I'm a horrible merchandiser. If I was a good one, we wouldn't have to give this talk today, right? You would all already be into the fold, so to speak. But in part of running that sale, I get questions from potential bull sale customers that say, why don't you send me all the actual birth weights, weaning weights, yearling weights, scan data on your bulls, and then also send me kind of a crude 3 or 4 generation pedigree. And then also if you could send me the average performance of those sire groups and their dams. Oh, and if you genotyped them, if you have those molecular scores separately, could you send those to me as well? And what they're trying to do is figure out how to weight all that information, right? Well, we do that, right? We do that in a very systematic way in the development of expected progeny differences or EPDs. And admittedly, the algebra behind that, Bob, isn't easy, right? That's part of my teaching responsibility at UNL, but it's time proven. We know that it works. So we combine all those different sources of information and weight them appropriately. So what we're trying to do when we develop or estimate these EPDs is really separate the proportion of differences between animals in their phenotype that are due to differences in their genetic value. And that ratio of the genetic differences to the phenotypic differences is what we call heritability. And I think most of us recognize that in some form or fashion. This kind of ellipse here represents the totality of it is the amount of differences there are in phenotype. The white ellipse then is the fraction of that total variation that's due to differences in genetics. And when we think about sire selection, that's what we want to focus on. The bull that you buy isn't going to pass on his advantages in terms of the amount of feed he got, right? He's not. The only thing he can pass on are his advantages in terms of genetic potential. So the basic model, P equals G plus E, right? I'm sure we've all seen this before. So phenotype, what we see, really comes about through the environment in which the animal is raised. So perhaps the climatic environment, the feed resources, age of the dam, those kinds of things, and then also their genetic potential. If we're a seed stock producer in the idealized world, we sell the G part. That's our goal, to sell G. Now, there's some seed stock producers here in the room, some fairly close to the front row, that would say, Matt, you said in the idealized world, we live in the real world, and we also have to sell what the bull looks like. That's unfortunate, because when we defer to what the bull looks like and not what his genetic merit is, we create an inefficiency in the beef industry complex. If we're a commercial producer, we want to use the G part, the genetics, to improve the phenotype, which is what we ultimately sell as commercial cattle producers. All right, so this phenotypic variation, the variation in what we observe or what we weigh, what we measure, can come about through several sources. One is genetics. Okay, their inherent ability to grow, to marble, whatever. That can be the additive part, which is what we select for through EPDs, or what we call the non-additive genetic part, which we as commercial producers can capitalize on via crossbreeding and heterosis. And that is a real phenomenon. It exists. It also comes about through the environment, so differences in forage resources, the dam's milking ability, etc., and then also what we may call systematic effects, such as sex of the calf, age of the calf, age of the dam, etc. And so when we think about sire selection, there are certain components of this phenotypic variation which cannot be passed on to the next generation. So if we think about what an EPD starts out as, it really starts out at the moment of conception as the average between the sire and dam's EPD. But it doesn't stay there very often, does it? Right? It deviates from that expectation, and it deviates due to something we call Mendelian sampling. So every time we mate a bull, he passes on a random half of his alleles, or think of it as a random half of his genes, and he passes on a different random half each time he's mated. That's why we see variation in offspring of a sire. That's why those of you that have full siblings, right, unless you're identical twins, you don't look alike. You probably don't even act alike, right? All of you probably finished a holiday gathering. Some of you have that crazy grandpa, right, that always talks too much, smells a little bit funny, probably drinks too much wine. And you think, how in the hell am I related to him? Well, the good news is, maybe you're really not. And now you're saying, he's saying mom lied to me. No, that what I'm saying is at the DNA level, maybe actually you're not very highly related to him. So this is actually empirical or true data. So we looked at using genomic data, the average relationship between individuals and their grandparents. Our expectation is that relationship is a quarter. But the reality is it can vary between zero and a half. So how do we parse out that Mendelian sampling bit? Historically, we collect data on the individual, data on their offspring, and over time, we get an idea of what their cumulative genetic merit is. Now, through the use of genomics, we can see these things, and as a consequence, we increase the accuracy of EPD very early in life. So let's think about the sire selection tools as we move from visual appraisal using raw weights, adjusted weights, ratios, EPDs. At the top is DNA markers, but as most of you know, that is seamlessly augmented into EPDs now. That's what we call genomically enhanced EPDs. And as we move from bottom to top, the costing of that information increases. But as we move from bottom to top, the accuracy then of our selection decisions also increases. So our ability to generate response increases. When bull prices really hit an all-time high here a few years ago, a lot of commercial producers call me and say, what do you think about me raising my own bulls? Well, they were going to select those bulls on visual appraisal, perhaps a few limited raw weights. And so, yeah, they could probably generate bulls cheaper, but the accuracy of the selection decisions they were going to make was also substantially lower, right? So seed stock producers put an awful lot of investment into generating information, which in turn can increase the rate of genetic change. So some of that information on the bottom tier there is about as valuable as this free cat right here. And I'm taking bids if anyone wants it. So EPDs, as we mentioned before, they really separate, as a Kansas farm boy would say, the wheat from the chaff. So as I alluded to before, we include pedigree information, that's historical and collateral relatives, phenotypes on the individual themselves, which is actually a powerful piece of information to have a phenotype on the individual itself. If they enter into a performance recording system, we get progeny information, and we also get information through correlated traits. So we can have a prediction for a trait we never even measured because we have measurements on traits that are genetically related. So we take advantage of all that. We sort out the environmental effects and, as a consequence, focus on that which can be passed between generations. We can use these tools across herds, but with some exceptions, generally speaking, they're breed-specific. So for seed stock producers, developing reliable EPDs starts with really developing reliable contemporary groups. So this is a cohort of animals that we treat in the same way. So if Bob has a group of bulls there at K-State, and he says, two of these are really shiny, I'm going to haul them to Denver, right? And he takes them out and he feeds them differently. Those two bulls don't belong in the contemporary group with the others anymore. He treated them differently. So that's an important thing. So they're all given the same equal opportunity to perform, of similar age, of similar sex, and we're able to identify which ones are able to outcompete and outperform the others. So the basis of all genetic comparison starts within the contemporary group. So here's a pictorial representation. For some of you will say, well, that's not even a breed that I use. Well, it doesn't matter. The example still holds. Assume this bull, actually a Simbra bull, produced these five calves across five different contemporary groups. And these numbers are the deviation from the contemporary group average for, let's say, weaning weight. So this calf outperformed his contemporaries at weaning by 30 pounds. This calf was 10 pounds lighter than the average of his contemporaries. And we can get an average of how his offspring compare to the average of their contemporaries, and that really becomes the foundation of an expected progeny difference. An important note here is that a sire's offspring actually exhibit more than three-quarters of the diversity of an entire population. Here's another way to think about that. I'm confident some of you in the room have purchased either half or full-sib bulls in an effort to create a more uniform calf crop for a given trait. What I'm telling you is that's a flawed thing to do. If you want to create uniformity in a calf crop for a given trait, select bulls that are more alike in terms of their EPD for that given trait. All right, so you may say this bull only had five calves. How confident are we in that EPD? Of course, all these EPDs have an associated accuracy value. Actually, we take that accuracy into account in the EPDs we publish, because we regress them towards the mean of the population proportional to how much we believe them, proportional to their reliability. So an unproven bull, we shrink him quite a bit towards the mean. A highly proven bull, we let him expand or float upwards or downwards. Here's a nice representation of two bulls. Let's say that one of them has an EPD of 40, another one has an EPD of 50. There's a distribution around those published values, right? These are expected progeny differences, but they're not the true values. As we get more and more information, we become more and more confident in those, and the distribution then around those EPDs begins to shrink, okay, because we have more confidence in them. The other thing you can see is that the distributions where the true value may fall for either one of these bulls overlaps between the two. Right? So our best estimate would be that these two bulls are 10 pounds different, but their true values may actually be very, very similar. Another point to make is that accuracy reflects our confidence in the EPD and their cumulative genetic merit. It does not predict the precision of that bull. In other words, it does not predict the uniformity of his calf crop. I think that's a mistake a lot of people make. Remember that whole Mendelian sampling, random shuffling of genes? That creates uniformity, or pardon me, that creates variation in calf crops. And from a seed stock producer perspective, I don't want to eliminate variation. Right? Variation is how I make change. It's how I make progress. So, Bob, a common question that's always asked is, do EPDs actually work? And what's the proof of that?
Yeah, great question, Matt, and I'll need the clicker from you. We did talk about it at breakfast. So, yeah, Matt and I both get questions like this, and the good news is there's some good data that suggests that EPDs actually do work, right? And, I mean, Matt and I are biased because it's what we do for a living, right? But we actually have some data, and one of the pieces of data I'll show you in just a second, but it's really important to recognize that if we think about this ability to generate response or control response to selection, having a tool that is useful and describes genetic variation is really important, right? It isolates us away from the environmental things that we control either via feed bucket or Mother Nature controls that, by and large, we have less ability to manage than the genetics do, okay? It's important to recognize that EPDs can be used to increase, decrease, or optimize performance, okay? There's an argument that's gone around for a long time that says that the reason we have, 1,400-pound cows is because people use EPDs. Is that right or wrong? It's right and wrong, right? It's not proof that the tool didn't work. If we used EPDs to select for lots more yearling weight, we got lots bigger cows, right? Because we didn't put downward pressure on mature cow size, okay? It's evidence the tool actually does work, okay? Now, the fact that we have 1,400-pound cows is another problem, right? That's representative of our inability as selectors to place the appropriate selection pressure to get the response that we wanted, right? Do you see the difference in that comment? Okay, so increase, decrease, optimize. And I think as breeds make genetic change, our necessity of making more optimal selections is becoming more important, okay? Understanding that maximum isn't always best is really key. Okay, so do not select for maximum genetic expression without regard to other factors. Okay, so cow size, nutrition conditions, you guys have all heard the spiel, right? So what's the evidence? Well, one of the pieces of evidence that I like to point to that EPDs really work comes from the scientists at the Meat Animal Research Center. Okay, so everybody knows Meat Animal Research Center in Clay Center, Nebraska runs a whole bunch of cows, right, in a giant breeding and breed cross experiment. And as part of that, they look at genetic predictions and progeny performance within their population as a sample of the broader national population. And then they go and look at the EPDs of the bulls that were used, the external, so the breed association-based EPDs that were used, the breed association-based EPDs of the bulls they use to produce calves at Clay Center, and look at the relationship between the differences in those EPDs and the differences in the progeny group means, okay? So that data is typically not used, the Clay Center data, in calculating the EPD. So they're independent data sets, okay? What we should see if the EPDs work is that a pound change or a pound difference in, say, the Angus EPDs, we should see a pound difference in their progeny performance at Clay Center, right? So we're using the EPD. It's a predictive tool that describes progeny group differences, okay? So Clay Center runs that data, okay? The pooled estimates of those regression coefficients, the expectation is that they're close to one, okay? So birth weight, this was from the BIF report from 2 years ago. Before a bunch of the single step stuff happened. So this is a little bit dated, but still representative of the tools that we all use. Okay. So these are all pretty close to one and describe, one unit change in EPD generally describes a one unit change in progeny performance across those traits. Okay. Separate data. So it's does the genetic descriptor actually describe progeny differences in terms of phenotypic performance? Data says yes, right? Those are all close to one. Okay, we put some breeds on here, the seven largest breeds. There's a little bit of variation, and part of these are scaling effects. Okay, but one of the things that's really important to think about is, as we make selection decisions, is the spread amongst all the bulls across the population the important thing, or is it the ranking of animals in that list? In many cases, it's the ranking, right? Especially if we're a seed stock producer and we're trying to make new genetic combinations, sometimes the rank is relatively more important, okay? Another really important question, and many of you already use these tools, and it's the idea of selection index, right? Many breeds publish a dozen or more EPDs across a wide range of traits. Are all of those traits important to any given endpoint? No. Okay, some of them are more important to some endpoints, and some of them are nonsensical to others. Okay, so it's really important that we have an understanding of what those are, and that's really complicated. That's called multiple trait selection, right? And figuring out what's the relative importance of calving ease versus weaning weight versus marbling score and milk EPD for different selection or different marketing schemes is pretty complicated, right? So we use selection index as a way to formalize that discussion. And Rick Borden in the late 90s, as the ERT discussion was really being formed, stated that there's no easily accessible, objective way for breeders, particularly breeders in beef and sheep industries, where ownership is diverse and production environments vary a great deal, to use these predictions intelligently. And by these predictions, he means what? EPDs, right? So that seat of the pants approach we've historically used is pretty complicated and has some risk. Okay, it's a lot better than not using EPDs, but it's still complicated. Okay, and we can make it simpler by building objective selection indexes to tackle the problem. Okay, so what is a selection index? All it is a formalized statement about what are the trade-offs between the different traits or different ERTs in an economic sense, okay? So we have the relative economic values or the weightings for each trait measured in dollars, and we have a list of the traits that influence, say, satisfaction or what our breeding objective is, and we simply weight the EPDs by those economic values to make this mathematical equation describe differences in profitability to some particular endpoint, okay? The nice thing about this is, it's objective, right? I can use relatively the same equation, possibly updated for economic terms each year or every several years, but it provides a really uniform way for me to describe the relative economic values in aggregate for a particular selection candidate, okay, to a desired endpoint, okay? And that's a really important and key aspect of selection index, is it simplifies our approach by not getting bogged down in the minutiae of, well, this one's 2 pounds better here, but he has a 1 pound worse or 1 unit worse calving ease. What's the trade-off? You don't have to worry about that. It's in the index already, okay? One of the other important things relative to index, okay, we talked about objectives early, right? So writing down your breeding objective is really important, and it keeps you out of deep water and dangerous territory, okay? One of the biggest selection risks you make is not putting emphasis and the right amount of emphasis on the right traits, okay? For instance, if you sell calves at weaning time, is milk EPD important to you in general? I mean, we can argue up or down what's the optimal level for your production environment, but no doubt it's got importance, okay? It's either got revenue or cost or both associated with it, okay? If I sell them on the rail, and I mean, in a terminal sire situation, I sell all the steer calves and all the heifer calves. Does milk EPD of that sire used to produce that calf matter? Not one single bit. Okay? It's got a zero economic weight. Okay? The importance here is that if you use the wrong index to your objective, you put the wrong emphasis on the right traits or the wrong traits. That's the problem, right? So understanding which is the right index and using it is key. So describing your production system, that first step we talked about, helps guide you to what is the right selection index to use, okay? Are you using a terminal index, and should you use that index, right? Or have you been using a terminal index to build replacement heifers, okay? Make sure you use the right one, okay? With that, Matt, are EPDs and indexes the only information that's available to us for selection?
Well, so when Bob and I were tasked with putting together this talk and visual appraisal was in the title, we honestly sat down and thought, where are the cases, particularly for a commercial cattle producer, where there is value in making a keep cull decision on actual phenotype? And so this you might call as our concession slides, Bob. We realize that selection is challenging. Producers are faced with selecting for multiple traits simultaneously, and not all the ERTs, economically relevant traits, have an associated EPD. And so it's critical to use the right tool for the right job. So let's think about bulls here for a second, and I think about quote-unquote visual appraisal. I'm using that loosely. It's really a raw phenotype as a pass-fail criterion. So did they pass a breeding soundness exam? I consider that a phenotype, yes or no. Right, a no says we question their ability to pass on their genetics, which is their job. Are they docile enough, particularly for small holders that may have to interact with those bulls frequently? Their actual phenotype for docility matters, and we recognize that. Feet and leg traits, are they sound enough to go out and breed cows, again, to be able to pass on their genetics to the next generation? So these are pass and fail criterion related to their ability to do their job. But we're not advocating in any way of using the raw phenotypes as a proxy of trying to determine how well are they going to improve those traits in the next generation.
That's the job of the EPDs.
So what about replacement heifers, pass-fail approaches? If you're a commercial cattle producer, there's logic, a vast amount of logic, in those females being composites of some nature. So are they that or not? What about the convenient traits? Many of the same ones. Feet and leg structure, docility, again. Can they do their job? Udder and teat quality. That one, yeah. Are they a nuisance? That's a convenient trait. But my experience, too, when I ask somebody to go out and score teat and udders, they'll find bad ones. Whether they're there or not, it's a comparative measure. So the worst one they see is going to be intolerable. So you've got to give that maybe a grain of salt. What I would say, though, and Bob would obviously agree, is if I wish to improve the heifers that I have the opportunity to retain, the lion's share of that improvement is going to come from the bulls that I used, right? It is the bull sire selection decisions that drive improvement in the commercial females. It makes sense, doesn't it? How many calves would you like a bull to sire this next breeding season? I'm guessing you'd like him to sire more than one, right? But how many calves is a cow going to have? On average, probably less than one, right, on average. That's why bulls drive the changes that we make in the females. So you want to improve fertility traits by bulls that have better fertility EPDs. So what makes a heifer successful? This goes back to some of the phenotypes that maybe are important. Her age at breeding, when she was born, in the calving distribution. This is some work both from the Goodmanson Sandhills Laboratory, Rick Funston's over here, and also the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, Bob Cushman. And then also genetic effects. And I think it was mentioned in a talk earlier this morning about the fact that we can make genetic progress in fertility traits even though they're lowly heritable. This doesn't mean we can't make change. It just means it can take longer to make appreciable change. And again, don't forget the value of heterosis. Depending on what you value wean calves at, this value of a crossbred cow can easily be upwards of $150 a year. And folks, I know there's popular press dogma out there that says the opposite. This is as proven as the round wheel. It really is. All right, some of those other phenotypes I mentioned before, when she was born in the calving distribution herself, but also when she calved when she was at her first parity. So this is some work from the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center led by Bob Cushman, they're a reproductive physiologist, so don't tell him that we included work from his in a genetics talk. But down here we have the time of first calving on the y-axis, the number of years that she stayed in the herd. And what we see is an advantage for the females that are able to calve earlier in the calving season during their first parity. They were able to stay in the herd longer. So that's a phenotype that for a commercial cow-calf producer actually does matter. A different look at that would be the effect of when she got bred during the breeding season and the impact on the weaning weight of her calf. If you think about that, if a female breeds up earlier, she likely calves earlier, and as a consequence, her calf has an unadjusted weight advantage compared to the contemporaries. And that's exactly what we see here, and a difference out to about P6 or parity 6 or 6th calf. So the females that are able to conceive earlier maintain that advantage and had an advantage in their calf's weaning weight all the way out to her 6th calf. So these are phenotypes that we can seed, might be important to select upon if you're a commercial cow-calf producer, given that you sell the actual phenotype. So with that, maybe a couple parting thoughts. One question for the group: how many of you came to this meeting by a means other than a vehicle on the road or an airplane? No one? No one rode their horse? How many of you can explain to me in great detail how the engine of your vehicle or how an airplane works? Then why did you come here in a vehicle or an airplane? And sometimes airplanes crash, right? And sometimes vehicles break down. But you made the conscious decision that even though I don't know exactly how they work, that is a more efficient means of getting from point A to point B than the other options I have available. So why in the hell don't you make the same decision with these tools? Right? The other point I want to make is I was on a call the other day with the breed association. They were talking about kind of their thrust going forward. How do they become competitive with other livestock protein resources, pork and poultry, in terms of consumer satisfaction, all those kinds of things? You know a big difference between those two entities in the beef industry? It's not the tools they have available to them. It's their utilization of the tools. Vastly different. So it's hard to rationalize how we'll ever be competitive when we have the same tools, we just elect not to use them. If you want more detailed description about a lot of those tools, this is a pretty neat educational website, ebeef.org, put together by, from your left to your right, Dare Bullock, University of Kentucky, Jared Decker, University of Missouri. Megan Rolfe was started when she was at Oklahoma State, now at Kansas State. Allison Van Eningham at UC Davis. Bob Weber's the tall one, and I'm the short one. And this is an educational resource meant for producers and extension personnel that covers all things beef cattle genetics related. So appreciate your comments as you go through that. Bob, I don't know if you have any parting comments as well. I think I already offended everyone except for the person that rode their horse to the meeting.
I'm actually happy with you. You said I was the tall one, not the bald one.
So. Yeah. Well, I stuttered.
I often get the other one. So, no, seriously. Yeah. Now, I think one of the things that stands out, the more, on the replacement heifer side, we talk a lot about selection of replacement heifers, right? It's something that many of us spend a lot of time and effort and thought as we approach that decision. And the challenge really comes down to, when we think about the genetics piece, really making sure we get the order of operations right. And really that your point on sire selection driving genetic change and genetic improvement in replacement females is exactly right. And it's in the context of our selection decision. If we've got a calf crop that's, say, 90 days long, and there's a heifer that's born on the very last day of the calving season that has the best genetics, what's her long-term likelihood, based on the Cushman data, of being successful in your herd under that 90-day breeding season. You're better off going to Vegas, guys. Okay? She misses once, she's out. Okay? A $2,000 or $2,500, or if she's a seed stock heifer, a $3,000 or $4,000 bet with not very good odds. Okay? And the data on the phenotype of heifers as a date, when they were born and when they conceive, is really important. Okay? And it almost, you know, the genetic decision's already been made about what genetics are floating around in your cows or your replacement heifers by that point. Don't agonize on trying to figure out, well, which heifer's the best one. There's good strategies in terms of either picking them by date or exposing them, taking a big group of them, exposing them to a short breeding season. Keep the ones that settle. Feed the ones that don't. Okay? Like feed them for the packing plant. Feed them. Okay? So put some tools in place that really optimize your ability to diminish risk and capture the ones that fit phenotypically into your system. Okay?
Well, I know Bob and I are both going to be around for the bullpen session tonight, and we've both been a part of this event several times before, so we're anticipating a lively event this evening.
And we lively welcome debate.
Welcome all the questions. We'll probably welcome some comments, but if they turn into long-winded comments with no question, we'll probably shut them down. But welcome the questions. Steve, I don't know, or Joe, if we have opportunity to take questions here or not. Yep. If anyone has any burning questions, Bob or I'd be more than happy to address them here, particularly if you're not going to be here this evening. Yes, ma'am.